Thanks, Erin. I also want to thank the Shelley Yoder with the Eating Disorder Disorders Coalition. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
Right. For asking me to give this talk, although this doesn't have a precise tangent into eating disorders. Hopefully at the end it will be clear how this has implication in terms of women's image and how women's images are used both in the unfolding of prenatal care and other forms of care. My main point on this is that who cares for women? The person that is chosen and is charged with caring for women and women's health is going to, in some sense, have an impact on the kind of care that is ultimately delivered, on the outcome and on the experience that that particular woman is going to have. And just to clear up, episiotomy is not really a household term. Episiotomy is a procedure that is performed during birth. It has been very much contested in the past sort of 15 years or so. And one of the reasons why it is contested is that because its alleged prophylactic value has been questioned. And so by prophylaxis, episiotomy was performed to prevent lacerations of the perineum and a prolapse, bladder prolapse, in some cases also uterine a prolapse. However, in the past, as I said, sort of 10 to 15 years, increasingly randomized controlled trials have been performed that have showed that actually this procedure does not prevent uterine or bladder prolapse or lacerations. So its prophylactic value has been increasingly questioned. One of the elements on which episiotomy seems to still retain some value is on whether it will speed up the delivery of the fetus. So both the WHO and medical researchers have established selective use of episiotomy as a good standard of care at present. However, there have been problems in implementing this standard of care. And in a number of places, episiotomy still remains a routine procedure. And in the case that I'm going to present to you today, which is from Italy, in a hospital where episiotomy was still performed routinely, you will see what sort of dynamics allow this procedure to persist. Now, to really give you an idea of what this procedure is like, I'm going to show you a kind of graphic depiction. So if you're a bit squeamish or you don't really want to look, especially, I apologize because this is a lunchtime talk. If you don't want to look at it, please don't look. This is after an episiotomy is performed, and you'll see this is the vulva, and this is where the incision has been made. And just like in the model before, you have seen the incision was going on the lateral, was going to be performed on the lateral plane. That's what has been performed in this case. And you see that there is quite a bit of trauma there. So this is not a sort of light procedure that doesn't have an impact on a woman's reproductive system. Okay, so this has an important impact. So a number of people, including Marsden Wagner, who has a background as an epidemiologist and also as someone who has been an episiotomy critic for a number of years, have been drawing connections with the fact that episiotomy itself is a form of female genital mutilation. And the arguments that they've put forth, although they seem to be very sound, at least they seem sound to me and to a number of social scientists who have been involved in studying this procedure, they have not quite had enough resonance in the medical establishment. And a few years ago, in 1999, The Lancet, whom we may know is a very important and very popular medical journal in the United Kingdom, published a review of articles that had to do with clitoridectomy and how clitoridectomy was performed in England and in this country as well. Beginning at around, it really had been performed for a number of years for very different reasons. So if we could track it back, we can track it all the way back to the Romans and probably even before that. But in the medical sense, that physicians were involved in performing clitoridectomy for medical reasons, this really came out in the mid-1800s. And in 1866, Isaac Baker Brown, a London-based surgeon, he started writing about this procedure and saying that it was a procedure that, if performed, could resolve problems such as epilepsy, manic hysteria, and a number of other conditions. So in 1999, The Lancet published this review of all of this literature. And Marcin Wagner jumped at the opportunity of tapping into that same kind of argument about female genital mutilation and saying, look what we did. We changed and we're not doing clitoridectomy anymore because we recognized that it had no effect. It had no clinical value. Why don't we do this for episiotomy? Can you guess how many responses his reply to The Lancet had? It was one response, and it was from France. And the response was positive. But nevertheless, there just doesn't seem to be much of an interest for episiotomy, which in my case makes me particularly curious about the lack of curiosity and about the procedure and what is this procedure doing that we're not quite grasping. So I just want to go back for a little bit to this issue of clitoridectomy in the 19th century. So as I said, 1860s was when this argument was really raging. And Baker Brown was, like it says here, he advocated the use of this procedure for epilepsy, hysterical mania, various forms of insanity, mental diseases. And it wasn't until Charles West, who was a doctor also, I think he was London-based, although I'm not sure about that, who published a very important treatise on the diseases of women. It wasn't until he started criticizing the practice of this surgeon that a full inquiry was launched. And The Lancet spearheaded that inquiry. And there was a moratorium on the use of clitoridectomy for any of those procedures such as epilepsy. And of course, it excluded pathologies of the clitoris, which is, another way of the pathologies also constructed in a sense. So, however, but in their particular case, they were talking about, we will still remove the clitoris if someone has a cancer or if there is an abnormal growth and so on. Although, if you really look at the articles that were being published, you see that the clitoris was deemed to be abnormal, was deemed to be too big or too small. So how these abnormalities are constructed and what they're tied to is a very interesting mechanism. And in many cases, it doesn't have, at least at that time, it didn't have a whole lot to do with the medical evidence. So the Lancet investigation went on, and what they were really bothered after the publication of a number of replies and letters to the editors and to the various authors was that they couldn't achieve an authoritative collective opinion. They were really bothered by that. It wasn't an ethical issue that this procedure was being performed on healthy women, and the idea that we have today of evidence did not exist. The issue was that there had to be some kind of collective opinion so that the surgeons and the doctors would look like they knew what they were doing. Now, England and the United Kingdom are not the only place where genital cutting has had a place. In this country in particular, circumcision and genital cutting of males took place and continues to take place today for various reasons. Again, this time period, 1890s, mid-1800s to early 20th century, circumcision of African-American males was a very hot topic. A number of people advocated this procedure to control the natural, what was thought of it as the natural drive of the solution of the Negro rape problem. So misbehavior, finding a surgical fix for what was perceived to be a moral problem. I think it's really interesting that surgery comes into this debate with a fix, with an idea that, oh, we can take care of that. We'll just snip a bit from these people's bodies and we'll see how it goes. Again, the ethical implications of this were never really considered. And they were always pinned against this sort of public health idea, that this made good public health sense to carry out these procedures. In the United States, clitoridectomy was also used. It was used slightly different. There wasn't a direct connection with epilepsy or mental diseases. As you see, the sources that I'm citing there, Hale, Willard, Elting, and Eisenberg, all of these authors and a number of others were concerned with nymphomania. And at that time, nymphomania was any kind of masturbatory activity that one engaged with could be labeled as nymphomania. Anyone who pursued sexual gratification outside of the quote-unquote normal confines of marital sexual interaction, and any of that, especially for women, was deemed as being nymphomania. So this was really a problem with women pursuing their own orgasms and taking charge of their own sexual pleasures, and that was regarded as being deviant. And interestingly enough, also the lack of sexual pleasure for women was deemed to be a problem, especially as you see in this other source that I cite from 1904, where he talks about a woman performing clitoridectomy on a woman because she had failed to respond to the marital embrace, meaning she had not been able to have an orgasm during normal sexual intercourse, and the normal sexual intercourse is described in the source as being sort of having sex in the classic missionary position, and that was pretty much it. So you see how, in this sense, clitoridectomy was very much about driving and directing women's sexuality. And there was an article recently in the American Journal of Bioethics that talked exactly about this, talked exactly about the ethics of circumcision of both men and women, and the different standards that we use in men and women, and how the ethical issues are really not being addressed. Another issue that this particular source doesn't deal with is the fact that the history of clitoridectomy in the West is completely silenced. Whenever Western researchers report on clitoridectomy in Africa or in other parts of the world, this very uncomfortable history that we have within our own medical sphere is very much silenced. And so, at least in my opinion, I think that that is certainly part of the problem. But what this is driving me to is the fact that this points to the fact that at that particular time, there was a surgicalization of obstetrics. What do I mean by that? I don't want to go in a sort of long explanation of how surgery and medicine interact with one another, but I'm just going to use the case of Italy because this happens in different ways in different countries. So we can talk about the English and American case perhaps in questions. In Italy, for example, what happened is that, unlike the UK and the United States, midwifery was never outlawed. And a number of efforts were made to contain, incorporate, and subordinate midwives within the general medical order. Also, women were not routinely excluded from medical education, which is also very, very different from certainly from the English context. In the American context, that is somewhat true. Some women were routinely excluded in different parts of the country, but there is a lot of variation with that. And if you know about the Flexner Report, you will know that the picture of American medicine before the Flexner Report was substantially different from what it was afterwards, and women were a big part of that. There were women's led medical schools before the Flexner Report. So there is the historical dimension here is very important. As far as Italy is concerned, in the 1500s, that was the first time that there was a first attempt to bring midwives within the medical hierarchy. The main problem was that after the Counter-Reformation, people were concerned that all these babies were being born and they were at risk of dying, and so they needed someone to baptize them. So they said, okay, so we give the midwife the right to administer baptism so that when these babies are born, if they at least they can be baptized before they die. So that was the first attempt from the ecclesiastical orders to bring midwives within their own hierarchy, but also to really control what they were doing. Because one of the things that midwives were doing, and they did at least in Italy all the way up until unionization under the fascist regime of Mussolini, was that they performed abortions. And that was a huge component of controlling midwifery practice. And then at some point in the 1700s, surgeons and surgical skills come into the medical context, and they come to dominate and replace physic and diet and all of the other tools that doctors had. And so the surgeon really come to replace the physician in the medical schools that are developing and that are growing at this time. And so it's the surgeons who start teaching midwives how to deliver babies. So this is the first time that this switch begins to happen. There are lots of changes in the way that hospitals are organized. There are lots of changes in terms of the roles and who does what. But this is a very important pivotal point in the sense that of the didactics of teaching midwifery and learning how to deliver babies. So with this in mind, when I arrived to do field work in Rome at a hospital that I'm calling St. Mary's, and that's obviously a pseudonym because I have an agreement of confidentiality with the whole institution, not just with the individuals. Otherwise, they would never let me do this kind of research. This was the greeting. This happened on my very first day when I arrived and I was introduced by an OBGYN. And I think it was interesting, Dr. Rossi's response of, what's an anthropologist doing here? And his response about, why would I want to observe the folkways and mores of obstetrician gynecologists? That really signaled to me that this person also had a view that, we don't have folkways, we have protocols, we have science, we have evidence. There is no doctrine here. This is all about science. And all of these physicians, all of these MDs, OBGYNs that I talked to, they were all very active in publishing in medical journals. Most of them published in Italian medical journals. But this was at an institution that was very active in implementing evidence-based guidelines and the like. So this is not a sort of backwater hospital that has no exposure to the latest evidence, to the latest journals. They have PubMed, they had Medline, they had everything that they needed to get the evidence that everybody else has. And I apologize for, because this is not very clear. So I started my inquiry, and one of the first things that I looked at was this report by WHO in 1985 about having a baby in Europe. And here it lists all the different procedures and whether women had a choice or didn't have a choice. And you see at the bottom, episiotomy, most places give you no choice as to whether you're going to have an episiotomy or not. And it's interesting also, if you look at the very top, perineal shaving, that's another procedure. That now both of these procedures, perineal shaving has been completely proved to be completely ineffective, and actually it's detrimental because by shaving you would introduce a higher risk for infections. But these two procedures are the sorts of things that I looked at more closely. Enema was another routine procedure that I looked at because it was performed routinely where I was. And this is a sort of flowchart that the WHO came up to try and begin to understand the dynamics of the prenatal period. What is happening in the prenatal period that may shape the final outcome? And one of the things that they looked at was a high level of screening. In Italy in particular, ultrasound scan rates are extremely, extremely high. It's not uncommon for a woman to have in excess of 10 ultrasound scans throughout the pregnancy. And the frequency of these scans may very well increase towards the end if there is any suspicious, if there is any question about the well-being of the baby, or if there is any question about... There is a fluximetry, which looks at the placenta and how well the fetus is being oxygenated. So there are a number of different procedures that are performed. And you see here that there is a great potential for electronic fetal monitoring to lead to an operative vaginal delivery, either a vacuum delivery, use of vacuum or forceps, or from the other side to lead to a C-section. Now, there was a great deal of awareness about climbing C-section rates. And so there was a lot of concern about this kind of movement, but where I was. But there wasn't a whole lot of concern for episiotomy. So as I looked at the various evidence in the medical literature, this review in 1995 also pointed at the fact that there is no evidence. This was a review by Murray Enkin, who is also an epidemiologist based, I don't know if he's based in Copenhagen or in Oxford. There are two epidemiology units, one in Copenhagen and one in Oxford, where they do specific monitoring on maternal health. And he's the author of this Guide to Effective Care in Pregnancy and Childbirth. And this was the first text of its kind to look at the Cochrane Review. The Cochrane Review looks at all the randomized control trials, the highest level of evidence. It's the holy grail of evidence within the medical establishment, although randomized controlled trials really can only give you a certain kind of data. So it's very difficult, for example, to measure social implications in randomized controlled trials. So here it was, the evidence a comprehensive review of the Cochrane database saying there is no evidence, none of the randomized controlled trials performed point at any effectiveness in these types of outcomes. Now, this is an Italian textbook that I translated, and this was an Italian textbook which was one of several that was in use at the time that I was at St. Mary's. And then St. Mary's was also a university hospital. And so what the text, you can tell from the language, for completeness, we register that for some time, some opinion groups, mostly extraneous to the medical profession, contest the traditional indication to perineotomy, which is another word for episiotomy, maintaining that the majority of perineotomies represent only the arbitrary interference of the doctor. And they cite Sheila Kitzinger and Penny Simkin, who are, Sheila Kitzinger is a, much like Wagner, is a longtime anti-episiotomy advocate. And Penny Simkin, I think by training she's a midwife. And it's just a little bit iffy, because by this time, for example, there was a randomized controlled trial conducted by Jennifer Sleep, who was a UK-based midwife, that was had already started to point at the fact that episiotomy had no prophylactic value in terms of protecting from tears, and that was specifically in protecting from tears. So here we go, Pescetto, this 1989 source, still being used in 1998. We may say that it's outdated. The view is certainly outdated, does not reflect the tone of the evidence at this time in the international medical press. And so I decided to go and have a look at the episiotomy rates at St. Mary's. And it was thanks to a really good friend of mine who was a medical student at the time, who had been charged by the chief of obstetrics with collecting some of this data, that he shared this. He shared the data with me, although he didn't really have express permission to do that. And at any rate, this is not so significant in terms of, you know, just by being there, people were saying, yeah, it's performed all the time. Although when I interviewed people, some people would say, no, our policy is to use episiotomy selectively. So I was having these mixed messages through the interviews that I was carrying out. So when I looked at the data, well, there's really no doubt that this is a procedure that is being performed routinely. And one of the things that you can see, this is the total number of births with episiotomy, and these two columns show you an episiotomy with a laceration and episiotomy without laceration. But so what some of the people would say is that, well, so there it is, there is your proof that episiotomy protects from lacerations. Because if you perform episiotomy routinely, there you go, you see? There are very, very few episiotomies with laceration. And look at that, most of the episiotomies are without laceration. So what do you say to that? Well, first of all, I want to remind you to the picture that you saw earlier as of the kind of trauma that episiotomy causes. And the trauma that episiotomy will cause is at least equal, if not greater, to that of even a very large laceration. In fact, some of the other trials that keep coming out, a physician from Canada, whose name is Klein, I cannot remember his first name, he came out with a randomized controlled trial where he showed that actually episiotomies predispose to third and fourth degree lacerations, which are the kinds of lacerations that rupture well into the rectum. So that was an argument that a lot of people made. But I just really want to remind you of this, as to what an episiotomy policy, routine episiotomy policy does, is this. Very, very few women with an intact perineum. Almost no one. I doubt that is even close to 1%. And this is the sort of general picture in terms of comparing both the UK, the US, and Italy. So you see where Italy is. Italy is way up there. So you can tell, you know, from the 1980s on, it's been a very strong trend towards routine episiotomy. And in the UK, the trend has been more downward. And in the US, it's been mostly a downward trend, although episiotomy rates now are still around 50%, which is still far from the WHO recommended 20% rate. So one other thing, what was going on, and in trying to make sense of what was going on in this context, I started asking physicians questions about why would this routine protocol persist. And mainly their responses were along these lines, that it was good for the hospital because it was a teaching aid for student midwives. So the student midwives needed to know how and when to perform this procedure. Although if you have a routine episiotomy protocol, that's really a moot question because you're just going to perform it. But the argument was they need to know when they're going to perform it. And for residents, they needed to perform episiotomies because residents needed training in how to apply stitches. For doctors overall, it gave everyone an opportunity to inspect a midwife's work because midwives would not do the suturing, and I'll come back to this. And to midwives, they were guaranteed some kind of control over the birthplace, over the labor and delivery room. Yes, they had to comply with this unpleasant protocol, but it still guaranteed a space for them as compared to some of the other midwives who have been in other countries who have been completely pushed out of the institution and very, very constrained in what they could do outside of the hospital institution. And for patients as well, it guaranteed maternal and fetal safety. That's what the women would say. This is one of the chief of obstetrics and gynecology, and his explanation is because obstetrics no longer has the time, it doesn't have the weight. The weight was represented by the stretching of the perineal floor through which you could value attentively and calmly what was happening. Today, there is always the need to give birth in the shortest time possible. Didn't quite understand where that need arose some of the times, but this is very much perceived as a need to deliver in the shortest time possible, to do it sooner. Obviously, episiotomy became a routine, but it isn't even considered an operation. It's considered an integral part of birth. In fact, if you think back to the statistics that I showed you, if there is an episiotomy, an episiotomy is written down, and if there's a laceration, the laceration very often doesn't get recorded, even if there is a laceration. It's just written in the chart as episiotomy and then perineal repair for whatever stitches are going to be applied after birth. And this is from another interview that I had with another of the high-ranking OBGYNs. And this was after a long interview conversation about evidence-based medicine and episiotomy and the evidence and how, darn, you know, this hospital is just doing well, but we really need to focus more on this evidence-based knowledge. And, you know, I always tell my residents that they need to keep up with the literature, that they need to read the stuff and find ways to implement it in their practice. And translational research was all the rage. And then at the end of the interview, yeah, but anyway, the point is that what I always tell the residents, they need to do suturings to get their hands wet. If that is not a ritual, if that does not have ritual connotations in terms of embodying a particular mode of care, a particular mode of practice, I don't know what is. They need to get their hands in the blood, to feel that they're doing something, to feel engaged. And I also want to point out that engaged in Italian, he used the word the impegnato, which also has a connotation of that you're doing something important. So say, for example, you would say a serious musician is a musicista impegnato. So impegnato has that kind of word, you know, that they're doing serious work. So this is not a joke, and I'm not trying to sort of criticize the clinicians for doing this. But what I really want to point out that there are very strong social and cultural dynamics going on here that are beyond any kind of evidence that we can find. And so the analysis that I was giving you earlier about all the things that episiotomy does is very important in the reality of these clinicians on a day-to-day basis. So, and then is it ethical? You know, I'm just trying to go back to the question of Marzen Wagner. How do we establish best practice routines? The best practice, does it mean just, you know, people let us do it long enough? Is that best practice? That seems to have been the trend very much with episiotomy. The other disturbing element is that while C-sections were incredibly problematized, episiotomies at the same time were being completely normalized and dismissed. C-sections were a problem also because a lot of women were beginning to ask for a C-section. They'd say, I don't want to go to the vaginal birth thing. No, thank you very much. Yeah, elective C-section, that's my thing. And then OBGYNs would start saying, wait a minute. You know, this thing is getting out of control. We need to make people understand. We need to educate people about this. So in terms of episiotomy, my contention and my argument is that this really was really about inventing a new morality. The new morality was based on the fact that natural tears, no matter what the extent, no matter what the level of tears, were really unjustified. And they were very often reason for reprimand. I don't know that any midwife was ever dismissed because of lacerations, but certainly it was people could give them a lot of grief if they had a laceration without an episiotomy. If the episiotomy was there, people would say, well, you did all that you could do. You know, you did an episiotomy, she tore anyway, well, you know, what else could you have done? So that was the ethic. Again, episiotomy is natural. It replaces, it gives you also a way to control where the tear is going to occur. So it is very useful in that sense. And it gives people something to do. And you know the old saying, don't just do something, stand there. It's in a discipline like obstetrics and gynecology that is so intimately shaped by surgical acts. It's a very difficult thing to do, and it also had these other functional, structural implications in that it allowed the training and so on and so forth. But I think it really the underpinning of this procedure is the fact that it has been and it continues to be ethically neglected. It is not identified as an ethical issue. I'm just going to skip over that. And then what about the women? What's wrong with these women? Why aren't they doing something? Don't they see what these people are doing to them? There's a lot of feminist critique on episiotomy. A good bit of it is based on the fact that these women just don't resist. You know, and they just don't know any better. They're passive. Well, if you look at what they're saying, to me, they look like they're actually quite strategic in what they're doing, because what they do is really to choose the hospital, because to them, giving birth in the hospital is really the safest thing to do. And so the choice of the OBGYN is sometimes secondary, and certainly secondary to the hospital. And they don't, the midwife who's going to deliver them anyway, they're not going to know that person. And a lot of them don't even have any clue that the OBGYN is not going to be there, that it's a hospital midwife who's going to be there present at the birth. So in either case, it makes sense for women to just say, I'm just going to find an institution that I trust, and just stick with that. And the ethic of trust is very important. And also the question of the shared identity of the stitches. And so this is the question of biopolitics and how do we control women and what they do. Intellectual moral leadership here refers to the fact that this is a kind of hegemonic order, and hegemony has had connotations of it being kind of a bad word. I don't mean hegemony in a bad word. It's just hegemony works. So when you have an ethic that works, that gets buy-in from the public, that's when you can say that a particular system is hegemonic. And the fact that medicine is very effective as a hegemonic system means that people are buying into it. It doesn't mean that people are not being strategic. I would dispute that in a sort of feminist perspective, where sometimes feminist scholars talk about false consciousness in women. I think I'm more inclined to do away with the whole issue of false consciousness and understand hegemony as a kind of agentive process, a process that gives women agency. And what is the relevance to women's image? You can just begin to think about surgery in general and what it does and what it has traditionally done. You know, we started with clitoridectomy and we've sort of come through episiotomy. And here we are at sort of the other end of the spectrum, fetal surgery, which is the ultimate triumph in a way of surgery within obstetrics and gynecology, as something that if you've read work by Monica Casper and other scholars, you know there are very good arguments for these sorts of procedures as taking away maternal agency in order to bestow it on the fetus. And then there are, you know, fetal surgery is just one. You know, there's yeah. So this is from, I think it's from the LA Times. I found this scanned on the internet, and this is an ad for vaginoplasty. So this is all the rage now. This is what a lot of women are into these days. And it's interesting because if you look at how these physicians describe these procedures, they say they perform labial reduction surgery because some people's labia may be too big. Sounds familiar. You know, patients with enlarged hypertrophic or asymmetrical labia, they've left the clitoris alone because that is just, they're just not going to go there, and I don't think they're going to ever go back there. But they're reaching, and I think this is, I interpret this as an sort of infiltration into how we define who we are as individuals. And this is just the case for women. There are lots of different things, lots of different examples that we could come up with for men, you know, calf implants and various other things, penile enlargements and implants of various sorts. So this is not something that is exclusive to women. By any means. So this just really makes you wonder who is a prisoner of ritual. And I don't mean to diminish in any way the suffering of women in Africa and other countries who, or even in Western countries who are being shipped back to whatever it is to have their circumcision done because they just ought to have one. I, in no way I want to trivialize this, but I think we really need to take pause and think about what is it that different people are doing. If you remember in the aftermath of Katrina, one of the things that people were saying was that people were upset because they were saying it's like we're a third world country. There's a lot of resentment with saying, you know, we're not, we don't want to be that. And all of these arguments about science and about doing the right thing because this is science, and all of this construction of science that goes on has a lot to do with just building different rituals. So on the one hand, I think, yeah, you know, science and evidence, yeah, they do have a place, but we also need to understand the counterpart, which is inevitably going to be embedded in what we do. And thank you very much, and if you have any questions, please shoot.